is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Thank you, Dale, for the introduction. And we are here in the Christian War Room, and we are looking at the theory of evolution and how to debunk it. 100 ways to kill the theory of evolution. So far, we've been looking at the fathers of evolution. We've been looking at the scientific method. And we've had an introduction to everything to do with evolution. And now we are looking at number four. Number four is the whole concept of angular momentum. The whole idea is that, if the Big Bang was true, and if everything was going to be flung out into space, everything should really rotate in a certain direction, like you would assume by some of the galaxies, the way they spiral out. Now, when we look into our solar system, we've got Venus and Uranus, and I understand there are a bunch of moons as well, which rotate in the opposite direction. They rotate anti-clockwise. And why is this the case? Now, science obviously has to find an answer. Sometimes they just refer to it as an anomaly, and that's the end of the story. But then they come up with again, fancy theories, because the idea is that the Big Bang and all this is the truth, this fact, because it's been peer-reviewed, and it's stand the test of the scientific method. Therefore, it's got to be right. And they find anything, any explanation which might work it, and then they've got ideas that Uranus, they say, something the size of the Earth must have hit it, making it rotate in the opposite direction. I would think that you would find some impact on Uranus if something like Earth had hit him. They say something similar to Venus as well, that something must have happened, and the thing maybe got flipped upside down, and hence we've got the rotation in the opposite direction. Again, does it stand the test of the scientific method? I'm sure it doesn't. It does stand the test of speculation. From a creationist point of view, it's not a problem. God can do what he wants. Yeah? And maybe to just give us a little bit of awe and mystery, he has decided to let a couple of planets and a few moons rotate the opposite direction, spin the other way, rather than everybody else. Okay, number five. We find that some evolutionists, they use the ice core to date for time. And again, it's something for you to get into and to just see this. But you see this, they come up and they say, look, we know the Earth is old because look at the ice in Antarctica, look at the ice in Greenland. And we know that the Earth is millions and millions of years old because we can, trace back about 100,000 years of the ice. Okay, so far nobody's really been challenging it, and I thought, okay, fair enough. And how do you know that it's like that? And they said, oh, you've got layers inside the ice. And, we know when it's been warmer and when it's been colder. So the ice gets a bit more compressed when it's warmer because it might melt a bit or the texture changes slightly. So when you go through an ice core, made up of lots of snow, you can actually identify these layers. And then they say these layers stand for summer and winter. And they've got layers which are about... I think it's about a mile long or something. It's quite a lot of stuff they got out, and they got all these layers, and they decided, right, this must mean that that this part of Greenland is well over 100,000 years old, so the whole biblical theory of 6,000 years is out of the window. Okay, now this happened. World War II, some planes, they ran out of fuel, and they landed in Greenland. So, as the World War came to an end and they were pretty much in the middle of nowhere, they let those planes be there. And then over time they got snowed in, then they were covered in snow, and then a layer of snow went above them. And about 40 years later, I think it was 48 years later, some rich men decided, oh, there's these planes, and they sort of remembered this history. So they should be reasonably well preserved because they were in the ice. And so they tried to locate them. And when they found them, they found out that they were like, I think it was 40, 50 meters below ice, something like that. That was quite a long distance to go ice, or was it 40 feet? Still a long, long distance. Yeah. No, 48. Yeah, anyway. So they had to dig through the ice to get to the plane. So then once they were, you know, getting rid of all the ice, they got hold of the planes, they disassembled them, got them out, and then assembled them back somewhere in America. The question was asked to them, and was put forward to them, about these layers, whether they could see these layers in the ice. And the people who dug out the planes, they said, yes, we could see them, and we could see hundreds of them, hundreds of them. Okay, so we've got 48 years, and they saw hundreds, if not thousands, of these layers down the ice. So it wasn't a big issue for them, because that's not what they were looking for, but they just saw a lot of these layers. Okay, now the big question is, what do these layers stand for? And basically, it's just cold and warm periods. And when you think about it, and you, you know, they should have seen about 48 layers, but they didn't. They saw a lot, an awful lot more. So the suggestion is there that these hundreds of thousands of layers these people have seen, counted, studied, wrote papers about them, that they just came to the wrong conclusion. They are not representing years, they are representing possibly days, where you've got a warmer period during the day and then a colder period during the night. And this might generate these layers on the snow. Yeah. They've seen it, that's the evidence. So there's a strong call to reinterpret the data in the light of current finds. I doubt whether the evolutionist community will consider this. And then suddenly, when they've got these 100,000 days or something which they came up with, it doesn't quite work out to fit into 100,000 years. Let's do a quick calculation. I think the figure was about 100,000, which I heard. Let's divide 100,000. So we've got 100K. We divide it by 365. And we get about 273 years out of it, yeah. Is this right? 365. So we get... years. We get... If it is per day, about 273, yeah. So it's not 273 years. So it's not that that strong, you know. From Greenland, we know, by the way, you know, from medieval days, that there was a warm period on the world. That was just sort of in the late medieval period, and a lot of it would have been molten. So. Probably, and I know there's a lot of stories going around, and we are going back into history, where Vikings were settling down in Greenland, because it was a green land, and that was during this period of time, and then they abandoned it again later on, the reason being that the temperatures got colder, and Greenland became inhospitable. Okay, so that is the timing using ice cores. That was number five. Number six, the geographical column. That is number six. Let's have a look at the geographical column. We talked a little bit about this in the past. So that is when you've got like all these layers, which are supposed to be in the ground, and you've got the, you know, all the different names like the Cambrian, Jurassic, and so on. And in one of them, the dinosaurs lived. The other one, we just had very basic life forms. And then the last one, we came up. And so they tried to look at the strata in the ground and then interpret them using the geographic column. Again, I'm not an expert in this field. A creationist, they say that this column only exists in textbooks. But because this column exists in textbooks, people go, you know, out in the wild. They look at the stratas in the ground. They look at what animals are found in there or what fossils are found in there. And then they are dated based on this column. Now, all this theory comes back from a guy called Charlie Lyell. He lived from 1879 to 1875. And he was talking about the stratification of the Earth. He assumed that the Earth was very old, and he put dates and everything on there. And he was very much in favor of this column, yeah. And today the data we have and the suggestions we have comes from this time, from the 1800s, when people had no means of using dating methods in any way whatsoever, and they came up with this. There's a guy called Russell Wallace, and he had the same ideas as Charlie Lyell. He lived a little bit later, and he pushed the ideas. I hope I get these names right here. Let's have a look. We've got Huxley, Spencer, and I think that's right, Russell Wallace. And that's where it's all coming from. So always bear this in mind. This comes from the 1800s. Yeah, people didn't have the information available we have today. And then a lot of science today is just based on what these guys came up with. This was never really questioned, was never really tested. Very often dating methods are based on what people find in a certain type of layer, and they look at the count or whatever they're testing for, and then they turn this around. Can we rely on this? I've done some talks about the geographic column in the past, and one big problem is that you get a lot of things which don't tie up. You get all sorts of fossils in the same layer. I was talking to a guy in Crimea. He was a creationist, and sort of he was looking for arguments, and he was looking intensely into this whole thing about the stratification. And in Crimea, you've got a lot of mountains which through geologic movement were sort of split up, and you could see into all these layers. And the point he made is, he said, nothing makes sense what people find in those layers. You know, what's supposed to be in certain layers is not there. The stuff which is supposed to be in the upper layers is in the lower layers, and vice versa. Yeah? So people say, oh, yeah, you know, that's just like nature. It's throwing it all over the place. But it's not quite as clear cut. You know, it just doesn't make sense. There's a nice theory somebody developed based on a concept, on an idea, on a guess, which we talked about in the scientific method. They had a guess, then they start computing to see whether this guess is valid, and very often this computing consists of interpreting the data they get in a certain way to get the desired outcome, and that is a problem. It's not necessarily the truth. One thing sort of which I looked at is when I was talking about the geological column is that there are a lot of pictures which pretty much ridicule the whole concept of this column. One of them is that trees are sometimes growing or stuck in these columns through layers. Now, we are told each layer is a deposit which takes thousands, if not millions of years, and suddenly you've got a tree that is pretty much the same all the way through those layers. Where the bottom would be in one layer 1,000 years earlier, and in the next layer 1,000, maybe even 1,000,000 years later, and then so on. So the conclusion, the logical common sense conclusion we can draw is that this tree was deposited across the three layers at the same time when these layers were created, and yet these layers represent, according to an evolutionist concept, thousands, if not millions of years, yeah, long time periods. And obviously, if you had a tree, it would erode, it would wash out, and you would have very little left of this tree stump. And maybe the bottom is preserved through deprivation of oxygen and being stuck in clay. The top wouldn't certainly be preserved. You know, the one that's freestanding, it would just wither away, foul away, and it would be gone. So when you look at this evidence, this theory doesn't work. But when we look at the Christian version, there was a global flood. This flood had a massive impact. It would work. We wouldn't have the slightest problem, you know, with this theory. Yeah, no problem at all. There's also one example when we look at some of the stuff which happened in the 1800s. We're only going 100 years back, not 1,000 years. We had like a lot of hunting going on with buffaloes in the U.S. Yeah, so people tried to try their machine guns, and they were just killing them randomly and sometimes deliberately as well to deprive the Indians, which people consider to be a threat, of their livelihood, in order to change their behavior and to domesticate them. I don't know which term to use, or to, you know, force them into civilization or whatever, Western civilization. Now, so they were killing buffaloes right, left and center. And there were tons of buffalo corpses throughout the prairie. Now, when you look at the prairie today, you hardly find any buffalo bones. And there's none of this theory, you know, they go in the ground and then they fossilize over time because, you know, one layer gets on top of another layer. There's nothing left of them. This is after 100 years. Everything is rotted away. The bones have gone. The meat is gone. Everything is gone. So fossilization didn't take place. Okay, that was number six. You know, the geographical column. It's a joke. It doesn't exist. Okay, number seven is fossilization. Again, the idea, which is put forward by evolutionists, is that fossilization takes a long period of time. Something has to be in the ground for a long, long period of time. Again, that's a guess, you know, because it can't go back thousands or millions of years in time. And they don't know, simply. Yeah. So anyway, what we can observe today is that fossilization can take place in a fairly short period of time. We sometimes see this when people get buried, and they get buried in certain conditions. Some get mummified. There was one scenario where there was some subterranean river. I've heard a story. Again, it's anecdotal. Needs to be proven in a better context. But there was a subterranean river, so water was flowing through, and they buried people in this environment. And they realized what was going on there, and they had some people buried there, so they tried to better sort of, you know, take them out and bury them somewhere where they don't get affected by the water. And they were taking some corpses out, and there were corpses which were fossilized. There was a constant stream of water going through them, and instead of rotting away and decomposing, the meat, the flesh was, the bones were replaced with minerals, and they became fossilized. So you had fossilized human within a period of 20 years rather than thousands of years. And again, all it was just some chemical process which took place in the ground very naturally over a very short period of time. From a Christian or creationist point of view, that is not a problem to see all these fossils today. We believe that there was a major catastrophic event which took place on the earth, which is about, I think it's about 3,500 years ago now, isn't it? 4,500 years. Yeah, 4,500 years ago, and that was the flood of Noah. A lot of stuff was turned upside down. The world was in turmoil, and a lot of layers were pushed over and on top of one another. A lot of pressure with the water that was there, and anything carbon-based got fossilized, like animal remains, anything which was dead and got trapped in these layers. You had all the ingredients necessary. You had the pressure, you had the minerals, you had the water just flowing through them. And so fossilization can take place in a very short period of time. So that's been proven. Okay, number eight is coal deposits, coal and oil deposits. And interesting as well, they can be created in a very short time. All you need is something organic and a lot of pressure, and you can create oil. You can use coal to create oil. And again, it's suggesting a global flood and nothing else. Yeah. Number nine. We've got written history. It was quite interesting. I was going to university a long time ago, and I was studying Old Oriental philology, and you sort of got to see a lot of other lectures which were advertised on campus. And one of them is, again, you know, most people live from this paradigm of the theory of evolution. That's the paradigm for most people, the vast majority. I acknowledge that, and it's not a problem. Doesn't mean that it is right and that it is the truth. But anyway, so there were some people, and they said there's some weird stuff which is happening, is that when we sort of start digging and we go through different cultures, we don't see a lot of written stuff before a certain time. So what people said is, you know, we went from monkey to people running around with fire, you know, drawing little pictures in the cave, and then suddenly we understand writing, and we use script to communicate. And then you got this explosion of writing, you know, of written scripts. The day it struck me was quite interesting, and they said that it all kind of kicked off about 2000 BC. Yeah, round about there. So that it wasn't very old. And they said this was the move from oral communication to written communication. And that was a big lecture on this. I should have gone, but I didn't go. Don't know what the reason was. It's a long time ago. Nevertheless, this thing stuck with me. And that is pretty much the time after the flood. I mean, when he had Noah and his eight people, for maybe a little bit of time, you didn't really need to have written communication. But when, as population was growing and growing pretty fast, eventually there would be the need to have written communication, to write things down, to have books. And suddenly you got this transition from an oral tradition or oral communication to written communication. So this is number 9. Seems to suggest that the Bible is not that far out. Yeah. As a matter of fact, it seems to suggest that the Bible is spot on when you look at the history of written reports. Fits in with the timeline we propose. Okay, number 10 is the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon, the sides of the Grand Canyon are fairly high, and then everybody says, oh, we've got the Colorado River, and with the Grand Canyon we can very clearly see that that the earth is very, very old, because we can see the little river is carving on X amount of riverbed and is feeding it to wherever it's flowing into, I presume the Pacific. And so we can determine the number, the time. Okay, there are a couple of problems when you have evolutionists talk about this stuff or geologists talking about this stuff. One of them is that the sides of the Grand Canyon where the river exits is higher than the side where it comes from. Yeah, so again, you've got the valley and you go right to the top from where the river should have cut itself through, and that is actually a lot higher. And then the question comes straight away, how can this river do this? Yeah, water can't flow uphill. Not really. So it's not really possible. Okay, and straight away we've got a real issue. The creationist view on the Grand Canyon is that you had like a massive lake, and suddenly this lake burst through and a lot of water was released, and a lot of earth was washed away in a very short period of time as the water was rushing through with a tremendous amount of pressure, and that's created the Grand Canyon. And the river we've got today just came at a later stage when all this happened. There was some... I think it was Mount McKinley. I'm not sure. There was one mountain in Washington State which blew up, had a massive volcano eruption. And something like a miniature Grand Canyon was created in a couple of hours. And that was through some of the mud flows or some of the lava flows, which cut through through Earth and created something like a miniature Grand Canyon in that region. It was quite interesting to see, but it sort of confirms that this theory, which is given by creationists, is not that far out. Number 11, we've got cosmic aspects. We've got starlight, which is billions of light years away. We've got the, Hubble came up with a distance measurement using redshift. And he then came up with the figure how big the universe is. Again, you have to bear in mind all we have is telescopes. And we can theorize and philosophize about redshift and blue shift, and we've got the so-called Doppler effect, and then based on that one, we try to sort of determine how far the stars are away. Is this a precise science? And I would put it to everyone, I doubt it. Yeah. There's a lot of speculation in this whole aspect of science, and what's happening is that people take this on board, they come up with this speculation, and they consider this speculation to be fact. And then a lot of other experiments are based on this speculation. Now, there are a couple of issues with this, analysis from Hubble. That's where the telescope is named after. Even though he's done a lot of research, and I'm sure he's done great research, and some of his reasons are valid as well, there's no question about it, and he's a learned man. I don't want to down his work and in coming up with these conclusions, but... we have to sort of accept that there may be an error in the things he's saying. And there's no way for us to prove this, because we can't send somebody a light year away to find out whether Hubble was correct or not with this red and blue shift. Okay, what is the premise for that? Again, we have a lot of assumptions. One of the assumptions is that the speed of light is a constant. Again, it either is or it isn't. We've got measurements for the speed of light, which go back to the 1700s. And the measurements became more and more precise into modern days. I was once reading up on it. I don't fully remember all the experiments they were doing, but it was just looking at orbits of planets and when you can see them and so on, and sort of calculating them. And so they could determine the speed of light to some extent over vast distances. The thing is, if you do this, if you do what Hubble did, speed of light needs to be constant. The measurements we have from the 1700s onwards, we have got a very good suggestion, which is based on data, that the speed of light is slowing down. And again, it depends how you interpret the data. So if you, the error margins for some of the experiments were quite big, you can shift them to one side or the other to try and disprove this. But there's a strong suggestion when you look at the data that the speed of light is slowing down. And some people suggest that when you look what we have from 1700s to today, and it's sort of just a curve of an exponential function, that the speed of light, if it is an exponential function and the curve goes round, would have been near enough infinity about 4,000 before our time calculation, before zero. 4,000 BC, speed of light, pretty much infinite. And so that means stars could have been anywhere in the universe and they would have been instantly seen here on Earth. The other thing is, God could have created the stars with light. So, for example, when the Garden of Eden was planted for Adam to eat, it would have been planted with the fruit already in place so that he would have a source of food to eat from. So, again, that's very important to understand. So the Garden of Eden came with trees, which didn't need to grow fruit, but the fruit was already on them. Otherwise, he would have to starve for a year and would have probably been a very miserable creature, other than being put into paradise. Wouldn't be quite the paradise it should be. Okay, we are coming to an end. Okay, so we've gone up to 11. So this is a talk on 100 ways to kill the theory of evolution. Please research this stuff, research these points, Google them, see what creationists are saying. I'm just sort of giving you a little bit of a contents page of the stuff that's out there, reasons why the theory of evolution cannot work, and they don't have really any arguments to defend against it. As a matter of fact, when you see these debates between creationists and scientists, the scientists, they come across really, really poorly. I almost feel sorry for them. And they are just sort of mumbling along with their scientific theory, their peer review, and that this is science and the other one is religion. I tell you one thing, the theory of evolution lacks common sense, it lacks logic, it lacks a mathematical approach, with probability calculations and so on. And a lot of it is based on, literally, on assumptions, on suppositions, on presumptions, and they don't really get you anywhere other than following a big fat lie. A lot of the stuff which evolution suggests is impossible. A lot of the stuff the theory suggests doesn't get you anywhere. We are coming to the end of our talk. Stay tuned here, christianwarroom.com, for the next talk on evolution.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Sean Bourne. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to christianwarroom.com. That's christianwarroom.com.